Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question today, please press star followed by the number one on your touch-tone phone. You will be prompted to record your first and last name. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objection, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'll turn the call over to your host, Mr. John Leslie of NOAA Communications. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
Thank you so much, Marcella, and good morning, and thank you for joining this monthly climate update call, which is part of the suite of climate services NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. Today's update will feature three short presentations, followed by a Q&A session at the end. You can download the presentations of the speakers and follow along by going to www.ncdc.noaa.gov/S-OASTCAT/briefings. The first speaker is Jake Crouch, a climate scientist at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information. And Jake is going to provide a summary of the July U.S. climate reports and the drought monitor. Next is Tim Brown, director of NOAA's Western Regional Climate Center, who will discuss recent extreme heat and fire conditions in the region. And our last speaker is Dan Collins, a seasonal forecaster at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, and he will provide the latest El Nino, La Nina update and the monthly and seasonal temperature, precipitation, and drought outlooks for the next 3 months. And with that, I'll turn it over to Jake.
Hi, good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I'm going to start off speaking to slide number two on the slide deck you can download from our website. I will be talking about the U.S. conditions during July, but I did want to mention that our global numbers for the month of July will be released on Monday, August 20th. So since those numbers aren't available yet, I can't speak to them today. Looking at contiguous U.S. During the month of July, it was our 11th warmest July on record, with an average temperature of 75.5 degrees Fahrenheit, 1.9 degrees Fahrenheit above average. Looking at the map on the left, you can see how the temperatures broke down during the month. We did have record warmth as well as much above average temperatures across much of the West. California had its warmest July on record, and since July is climatologically the warmest month for California, it was ultimately their warmest month on record in our 124 years of data. We did see above average conditions also across parts of the South and the Northeast. We had kind of a pattern shift in mid-month where the first part of July was much warmer than average for much of the nation, but the second half of the month we did bring cooler than average conditions to parts of the central and eastern United States. Looking at the daily scale, daily warm records outpaced cold records at a ratio of 5 to 1. So for every one cold daily station record broken, there were 5 broken across the United States during the month of July. We did see below average conditions across parts of the central U.S. as well during the month. Looking at precipitation for July, the contiguous U.S. saw 2.8 inches of precipitation, which was 0.2 inches above average and near median. This did mask regional extremes. We had above average precipitation across parts of the Southwest associated with the monsoon, as well as the central and northern plains and the Northeast and much of the East Coast. We saw record precipitation in Pennsylvania, stretching into parts of Maryland. Pennsylvania was record wet for the month of July, and Maryland had their second wettest July on record. We did see below average precipitation across parts of the Northwest into the northern and central Rockies, as well as parts of the Midwest to the Mid-South. Though fairly near average precipitation and cool-ish conditions across parts of the Midwest and northern plains has resulted in a bumper year for corn for many locations, particularly in the northern plains and Midwest. South Dakota is looking at one of their highest corn crops on record, but areas to the south across Kansas and Missouri have seen a drought develop with crop conditions not as great in that part of the country. Looking at the first 7 months of the year, the average temperature across the lower 48 was 1.9 degrees Fahrenheit above average, also the 11th warmest year to date. The temperature map on the left looks very similar to the map that we saw for July, with above average and record conditions for parts of the West. Arizona and New Mexico each saw their warmest year to date on record, with below average conditions across the northern and central plains and above average temperatures across much of the east. East of the Rockies, we have seen very large swings in temperatures for month to month during 2018, but overall it's been near to above average for most locations. The average temperature for the first 7 months of the year was above average, and this does mark the 25th consecutive year that the January to July average temperature has been above the 20th century mean. Moving on, looking at slide number four and looking at the U.S. drought monitor that was released this morning, 36.2% of the lower 48 is in drought, and this is up about 6.5 percentage points since early July. We did see some drought improvement, particularly where it rained during the month of July in the northern plains, the southern and central high plains, as well as the southwest, where we did see that monsoonal precipitation filter in, particularly in early July. Drought expanded across much of the west, particularly into the Pacific Northwest. Drought also expanded and intensified in parts of Texas, stretching into the Mississippi River Valley and Great Lakes. We do see that epicenter of drought in the southwest, extending into the southern plains, and as I mentioned, those drought conditions in eastern Kansas and northwestern Missouri having impacts on crops at this time. Outside of the contiguous U.S., we did see drought expand in Hawaii, with abnormally dry conditions expanding to more than half of Puerto Rico, where they've been experiencing low soil moisture and low stream flows as we moved into the middle part of the summer. With that, I will pass it off to Tim.
Thank you, Jake. On slide five, this is a summary from Predictive Services out of the Reading office that was issued on August 1st. And I include the summary highlights here because they really depict what's been going on in the West, including California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and now Western Montana, as all these areas are seeing fires at this time. So conditions through the summer have been or were warmer and drier than normal, and they're expected to continue that way really through November. Another highlight is last year there was that very strong Diablo wind event in early October that devastated Napa Valley region. So this is just a reminder of folks that during August we typically don't see those events, but they can return in the September to October time frame. This year has not been much in the way of lightning in the West. Most of the fires, and particularly the big fires in California, there's been some kind of human component to those. And the relationship between weather, climate, and the fires are the fuels. And so with these very warm temperatures and the dry conditions, this is really drying out the fuels of all class sizes. So that's the grasses, the brush, and the tree vegetation, and actually in part because of a couple of years ago of the abundant or above normal precipitation during the winter spring, there's actually still an abundant load of fine fuels and brush at mid and lower elevations. So the potential is high for a lot of these areas because the fuels are available and the conditions are dry, and so the ignition potential is high. Slide six just shows a map from now 3 days ago of wildfire areas, particularly in California and up into southern Oregon a bit. This is a nice graphic from the San Francisco Chronicle. The lighter areas represent where the burn areas happened, and at the time the darker circles represent where the current main fire activity is at. So we can see that there are a number of big fires around the West that have done a lot, actually produced a tremendous amount of smoke. And so for much of the past month and perhaps a little longer, there's been a lot of air quality issues across the West, including the high potential for human health impacts. On slide 7, if we connect to kind of how we got here from a climate perspective, this is a plot of July overnight low temperatures in California, 1895 through 2018. You can see overall there's a trend in the nighttime temperatures, but during the last couple of decades, this trend has really taken off. And the importance of this in terms of thinking about wildfire is that during the night, if temperatures typically decrease, then humidity rises, and that also means there's more moisture that the vegetation, particularly the dead fuels, take in as they try and reach equilibrium with the moisture in the atmosphere. But if the nighttime stays warm and the humidity stays low, then fire behavior continues at can continue at pretty high levels, and so this ultimately impacts firefighting operations during the nighttime hours. And again, ultimately what this could lead to is longer fires and more smoke production. In slide 8, one last example of connecting the climate and weather to the dead fuels. These are plots from the Car Fire area in California and the Mendocino Complex. And basically there's three curves here to note. The gray line would be the annual average of this fuel moisture. The red line depicts the all-time low, and the blue line current year to date. And as we can see in both these examples, the current year to date is flirting with the all-time record low values of fuel moisture. And similar plots like this can be seen up into Oregon. And finally on slide 9, this is the Predictive Services Significant Wildland Fire Potential Outlook for August. The large areas of red in the western U.S., extending up into the Canada border. And there currently are fires in, of course, continuing in California, Oregon, Washington, western Montana, Idaho, and these extend on up into British Columbia, where just a few days ago there were 350 fires burning. And the last slide is just the outlook for September, just looking ahead a little bit. And these conditions really do not change much into September, so we'll likely have to get into October and November before we really start to see a decline of the significant fire potential. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dan.
Thank you, Tim. This is Dan Collins with the Climate Prediction Center, and I'm going to be beginning with slide number 11. On slide number 11, we're taking a look at the current sea surface temperatures over the tropical Pacific Ocean, as well as the El Nino Southern Oscillation, or ENSO, outlook. In the upper left image, you see the sea surface temperature anomalies. This shows you areas where temperatures are above normal in pinks and red colors, and areas where temperatures are below normal in blue colors. You can see that temperatures are essentially near average across the central and eastern equatorial Pacific near the equator. They're above normal in the western tropical Pacific Ocean, where you can see temperatures exceed half a degree or in some areas 1 degree Celsius above normal. There are above normal subsurface temperatures that have persisted for a number of weeks at depths of 50 to 300 meters across the tropical Pacific Ocean, not depicted in this image. But in the subsurface, those above normal temperatures are approaching the surface in the eastern Pacific, but have not emerged at this time. Away from the equator, you can see temperatures are above normal in the northern Pacific Ocean. And all of this together leads to current ENSO neutral conditions during this past month. Looking ahead at the ENSO forecast in the plot in the lower left of slide number 11, ENSO neutral is likely to change over to El Nino conditions in the autumn and into the winter. Chances for El Nino increase to about 70% for the November, December, January season or early winter. Now I'm moving to the monthly outlook for September on slide number 12. On the left, you see the outlook for temperature. On the right, you see the outlook for precipitation. Looking at the temperature outlook, this shows areas in orange and red where the probability of above normal temperatures is increased. It shows an area of white in the northern central U.S. and down into the southeast U.S. where it is noted as EC or equal chances of above or below normal temperatures there where signals are not very strong. The outlook indicates that there is an increased probability of above normal temperatures for most of the western parts of the U.S. and also for Alaska mostly. Probabilities are high or above 50% for above normal temperatures in the Pacific Northwest region. The probability of above normal temperatures extends through Texas and along the Gulf Coast to Florida as well, and there is an area where the probability of above normal temperatures is increased for September in the Northeast as well, and that exceeds 50% in parts of New England. You see high probabilities for above normal temperatures on the west coast of Alaska. This is due to a substantial decrease in sea ice relative to normal conditions from past decades. On the right now, moving to the precipitation outlook for September, we can see that the monsoon is expected to be robust through September. We have an area of green in the southwest showing increased probabilities of above normal precipitation. We also have an area of increased probability of above normal precipitation in the southern portions of the east coast of the U.S. There's increased chances of below normal precipitation in the brown areas, including the Pacific Northwest and the southern Alaska Panhandle. Also, along the western Gulf Coast, there's an increased probability of below normal precipitation for September. And on the west coast of Alaska, where you see that temperatures were likely to be above normal, precipitation is also likely to be above normal in that region. And that's also related to the warming and decreased sea ice. Now I'll be moving on to slide number 13 and the seasonal forecast for September, October, and November. The left panel on slide number 13 is the seasonal temperature outlook. The right panel is the seasonal precipitation. In the seasonal temperature outlook on the left, you see that most of the United States, including Alaska, is likely to experience above normal temperatures, or that is the chances of above normal temperatures are increased over most of the U.S. The only area where chances have not tilted to above or below normal is the area in the southeast, including Florida, where equal chances is indicated. Most likely areas for above normal for the entire season are in the southwest, Four Corners states, where probabilities exceed 50%, in New England and parts of the Northeast, where probabilities also exceed 50%, and in northwestern Alaska, where probabilities exceed 70%. This is the transition season, September, October, November, where ice would be forming and is expected to be less than normal along the west and northern coasts of Alaska during this season, so there is a robust signal for above normal temperatures during this season in that area. Looking now to the precipitation outlook for September, October, and November on the right, We see that it also indicates that the monsoon is to be robust through its the end of the monsoon season. So for September, October, and November, the above normal precipitation is most likely for the southwest, as well as into areas of California. I will note that that is not a monsoon signal directly in California. That is moisture from the eastern Pacific that is expected to be warmer than normal during the September, October, November season. Precipitation is usually small during this time of year seasonally. However, it still would be above normal. In the northwest, there's an area where probability of below normal is more likely, again, for the September, October, November season. And in the southeast and Florida, there is an area where the probability of above normal is increased. Alaska is indicated to have an increased chance of above normal precipitation for the September, October, and November season. Now I'll move to slide number 14 and the U.S. drought outlook. This outlook covers the period from today through the September, October, and November months. So this is a longer period than you saw in the seasonal outlook for temperature and precipitation, where they begin in the month of September. This begins with the current date. The drought outlook indicates in shades of gray that drought will remain but improve some, and in shades of green that drought will remove to the point of removal. You can see in the central plains and in parts of the Midwest areas of gray and green where the drought is expected to improve. This is because of precipitation that is predicted for the end of August primarily. So using the short-term precipitation outlook, drought is expected to improve in these areas in the central U.S. In the monsoon region, you also see an area of likely drought improvement, or in some areas where drought is not as severe, drought removal is possible. This is due to the forecast that you have seen for an increased chance of above normal precipitation for September, October, and November. However, in the Pacific Northwest and most of the West, and as well as areas of Texas and along the northern border of the United States with Canada, there are areas where drought is expected to either persist, or in cases where drought development, where drought is currently not occurring but development is likely, this is indicated with the yellow color and persistence is indicated with the brown. Below normal precipitation is predicted for the Pacific Northwest, and above normal temperatures are predicted across the West for the September, October, November season, and that leads to the persistence forecast for the drought outlook. With that, I'll be turning it back over to John.
All right. Thank you so much, Dan. All right, we will now take specific questions from the media. Reporters, please be sure to identify who you would like to answer the question. So, operator, please remind the call participants how they can ask a question and queue up the first one.
Certainly, sir. If you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by the number one on your touch-tone phone. You will be prompted to record your first and last name. Please check that your phone is unmuted before recording. If you wish to withdraw your request, you can do so by pressing star 2. Once again, press star 1 and record your name. We do have questions in the queue. Seth Borenstein, your line is open.
Yes, thank you for doing this, especially the stuff about the fire. And then, so this is for Tim. You mentioned that the regional dead fuel moisture index for both the Carr Fire and Mendocino complex are near record lows, and you said it's that way through Oregon. What about for the rest of the western fire region, essentially? How would you characterize the current conditions in terms of fuel moisture and how much and what is the humidity like and forecast for the next month in terms of, you know, in terms of fires.
Yeah, good morning, Seth. I'd probably have to look at a map, which I don't have immediately right in front of me, for what the fuel looks like around other parts of the West. I mean, I could look at it, but maybe not in time for this call. If you wanted to follow up with me on that afterwards, I'm happy to do that. And as far as a forecast of, say, the humidity on a monthly scale, we really don't have that so much. So I don't know if I have a good answer for either of your questions immediately.
I guess I'm actually at the same time doing something on wildfires and climate. And so if you look at the current conditions in California and expand a little to, the entire West, how would you characterize these conditions compared to historic? I mean, are we some of the driest, hottest conditions we've seen? I mean, obviously California just had its, as you said, its hottest month ever. But in terms of, overall, how would you characterize the fire weather conditions this year compared to past years?
Yeah, in terms of fire weather, again, especially in California and Oregon, we've certainly been much above normal in temperature. It has been dry, so that has led to these very low fuel moistures. You don't have to get to record low necessarily to have some of the fire activity that we've seen, but it has gotten low enough that we do see all this fire activity now up through the Pacific Northwest and into the Northern Rockies.
So you'd say it's extremely low. I mean, is it dangerous? I'm just looking for a sort of a general comment on how on looking at how bad this is.
Good question, because there's different ways to talk about that. So if we define it through fire danger, then yes, we've had a lot of days this summer of very high to extreme fire danger around the West. And fire danger might be the way that the public can most closely relate to the potential for fire, because I'm referring to the same kind of sign indicators that you'll find when you enter forests and parks and along the roadsides.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Brian Sullivan, Bloomberg News.
Hi, thanks. This is also for Tim. What exactly goes into determining the moisture content of these fuels? And then the second question I have for you is, looking out beyond September, California has had some of its biggest fires in October. What do you think the rest of the fall is going to hold for California specifically, but maybe the West in general?
Right. So, the connection to the fuels is there's really two types of fuels that are looked at. There's the dead fuels, and so this is, cured grass and dead vegetation that's in brush and the trees, in the forest, branches and downed material and that sort of thing. And so these fuels, they actually try and they mimic very well the moisture in the atmosphere, but there is a time lag to that, and that's when some of it can respond, within an hour. The bigger fuels, it can take several days to try and reach that equilibrium. So if the atmospheric moisture is not there, then these fuels continue just to dry out, not unlike how the soil would dry out, you know, without moisture to replenish it. Then there's the live fuel moisture. So there's obviously lots of live vegetation around. And those are typically measured by taking clipping samples and weighing them, and then you bring them into an oven and dry them and take the difference. And so we do have available some of the live fuel moisture measurements around the West as well. And you don't have to have, for live fuel moisture, you don't have to have record low readings necessarily, because there are certain moisture points that the vegetation just becomes. I don't know if that kind of answered your first question.
Yeah, you dropped out a little bit there at the end. I didn't quite hear what you said. After you said you don't have to have record low readings.
Oh, well, yeah, that for live fuel moisture, think of it as, you know, like a Christmas tree, right? When you first get it, it can be very wet and green, but over time it dries out, and the risk of it becoming more and more flammable increases, you know, with that drying. To a large extent, that's how we can think of these fuels out on the landscape. It's not really unlike that. And as far as the outlook, yeah, official predictive services seasonal outlooks continues this high fire potential through October, but begins to diminish in it substantially in November, except for California and particularly Southern California, as we get into also the potential for the Santa Ana season down there.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a question from Stuart Leavenworth, Sacramento Bee.
Hey, thank you for holding this call. I guess my question would be for either Tim or Dan. If the Pacific moves into El Nino, what will that mean for the West Coast and for risk of fires going forward? And also, what would it mean for areas that have burned recently? For example, would you expect increased risk of mudslides?
I'll let Dan start with the overview of
this, okay,
and I can add on a little more specifically about the fire.
Okay, sounds good, Tim. Thanks. I'll begin just to describe a bit of the outlooks as we go into winter with the, at that point, El Nino becomes most likely. So going into winter, the impacts of El Nino should be a strong jet stream and enhanced storm track into generally Southern California, but then there is the possibility for precipitation further north. It will increase the chances for this, but I guess we will all note that the last major El Nino did not produce as much precipitation in California as would be most likely during El Nino conditions. El Ninos and La Ninas, they often don't produce the exact canonical pattern everywhere. You get the enhanced precipitation in some areas, but maybe not entirely across the southern portion of the U.S., which is what is generally expected from an El Nino. Otherwise, the outlooks continue to be for above normal temperatures through into the winter. And I'll let Tim speak further to the west.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. So I like to think of it as the cycle of fire. If we have wet conditions, that will allow for vegetation to germinate and grow and provide more potential fuels for when it dries out again. So it really is a continuous cycle in that regard. So for areas that might see enhanced precipitation from El Nino, is where we would expect the fuel growth. And then after that, as soon as it dries out again, we would go back into a higher fire potential because of those fuels. As far as post-fire debris, it's certainly the storms. It's not always the necessarily the amount of precipitation that's impactful. It is the rate of precipitation, and those exact numbers I would have to look up. So it really depends on the type of storm that is occurring across the area. And you don't have to have, of course, El Nino storms to do that. I don't know if that kind of answered that question or not for you.
I wondered if one of you could talk about what you generally see during an El Nino in terms of snowfall during the winter.
I guess I'll take that. This is Dan Collins with the Climate Prediction Center. As I described, with an El Nino, what we would generally expect is across much of the southern U.S. enhanced storm track and increased chances for above normal precipitation. In those areas, it essentially comes out that in those areas where they normally receive snowfall, and if the temperatures aren't particularly above normal for the winter season, they would receive enhanced snowfall. You can often, over the Mid-Atlantic, for example, see enhanced precipitation and therefore enhanced snowfall during El Nino. However, snowfall is dependent on temperature as well as precipitation. It's a bit harder to predict in those regions where they get a mix of precipitation during winter dependent on the temperatures. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Next, we have a question from Patricia Kitchen, Newsday, New York.
Hi, thank you very much. And so, Dan, I think we can just pick up with what you were talking about there. So I'm interested primarily in like monthly seasonal outlook for the Northeast, and in particular, the Long Island section of New York. I know you don't zero in quite that narrowly, but so I was interested in factors that, so it's looking like so the coming month was tilting to be a little above normal in temperature, and then also for the 3 months 3 month period. So could you, and is it primarily based on El Nino? I guess I vaguely remember from the last time there was one that the Northeast is affected by El Nino, but there are other things that also kind of tug at the conditions. So could you just possibly give a little kind of basic outline of that to begin with?
Sure, absolutely. What you stated at the end there is the case that for the Northeast, there are other factors that affect the seasonal temperature and precipitation during the winter as besides El Nino.
The
primary factor is what's called the Arctic Oscillation. And so that's an oscillation between the Arctic and the region south of the Arctic. In surface pressure, and this has a fairly pronounced impact on the Northeast as well as El Nino Southern Oscillation.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, that you can get from El Nino's an enhancement of the precipitation up the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
our outlooks that were released this week today for the winter do not extend the area of normal precipitation to Long Island, but it is true that sometimes storm systems that track up the East Coast will reach as far as the Atlantic and Northeast.
Yeah.
And so it is possible that you can get greater winter storms into that region, but our uncertainty is greater in that area as well. And in the current outlook, we're not predicting a tilt in the probabilities for above normal precipitation during that season.
Yeah, and that would be for what was it's like September, October, November?
I was looking further ahead. I mean, September, October, November, you can see the outlooks in the presentation.
Right. Oh, I see. So you were, you were talking about what, like regular winter? Like
yeah, and you also asked the question, right, you reminded me. You asked, are these outlooks based primarily on El Nino impacts? Uh-huh. And for the September, October, November season, I wouldn't say so. We use a dynamical computer model forecasts for our outlooks actually through several seasons. And in this early season, we rely primarily on those dynamical model forecasts, as well as El Nino has less of an impact during the autumn than it does during the winter. So we expect as the winter approaches that El Nino would have a greater impact. Even if it onsets early, it'll have a greater impact as we go further into the winter.
So what you had been talking about then was sort of your traditional winter, which would be December, January, February?
That's right. When I was talking about the potential for an El Nino impact.
Right, okay, yeah.
I was talking about.
Sure. Okay, that's great. And so you mentioned the Arctic Oscillation. Is that also called the North Atlantic Oscillation? I get my
They're very closely related. They're derived with two different methodologies to identify the strength of those. But they essentially, the North Atlantic Oscillation shows a pressure differential between essentially Greenland and the North Atlantic, and the Arctic Oscillation shows a pattern of pressure oscillation between the North Pole and areas surrounding it at subarctic latitudes.
Okay. So, and if you were called on to explain what these oscillations are, let's say to a kindergartner or maybe somebody in fifth grade, how might you kind of say what these things are? I know that it's a big, massive area that sort of it has to do with different pressure levels and things.
Right. So we tend to derive these simply by looking at what are the most common patterns of pressure differentials between regions in the Arctic Ocean. Sometimes higher pressure over the polar region, sometimes higher pressure at lower latitudes, and variations between high and low pressure between those latitudes. In the North Atlantic Oscillation is the same idea, that you can have oscillations in the pressure over one region or another. The El Nino Southern Oscillation, or ENSO, is referred to Southern Oscillation because the Southern Oscillation is identified by pressure differentiation between the Western Pacific and the Central Pacific.
Okay. Well, that's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We have a question from John Boyer, Richmond Time-Dispatch.
Yes. Hi, thanks for doing this. And my question would be for Dan as well. And looking at the September precipitation outlook, I'm wondering if you can expand on those increased probabilities for above normal precipitation in the coastal southeast, particularly up toward Virginia. And would you characterize that as persistence of the really wet pattern we've had in this region since May? Or would there be any new factors coming into bear?
Actually, that is correct, that the forecast that we have going into September from, again, computer models suggest that the pattern will somewhat persist. I wouldn't assume that this is going to result in the precipitation, the amounts of precipitation that perhaps we've obtained so far, but but it does, if the pattern persists in this fashion, then it does lead to continued above normal precipitation, at least up into the Mid-Atlantic region.
Okay. And sure. And is there any kind of signal at all related to the tropics that's at play here, or is it really apart from that?
I think in the case of the East, in the case of the East Coast, I wouldn't attribute too much of this to tropical impacts directly. The tropics in the actually the tropical Atlantic has been has had below normal activity in terms of tropical systems. So there is below normal precipitation over the Gulf and the Atlantic generally. It's not feeding as much moisture in terms of any sort of tropical systems. But to some extent, moisture along the east coast of the United States is drawn up from the Gulf, which does have above normal sea surface temperatures at this time.
All right. Thank you so much.
Our next question will come from Craig Miller, KQED.
Hi, thanks for doing the call. I have a question actually for Dan, and then possibly one for Tim, if you've got the bandwidth for that. I know out here, and forgive me if I got distracted and you've already covered this, but out here in California, I know the actual correlation between El Nino and precipitation is driven by the strength of an El Nino, not just by the fact of it. When do you think you guys will get a handle on the strength?
Well, I think right now I would say that we do have forecasts that give us different magnitudes for the El Nino, and currently this El Nino seems more likely to be either weak or moderate. We don't actually produce forecasts. Official forecast of the strength of the El Nino. However, as I said, currently there aren't really calls for a very strong El Nino. I think that you could perhaps say that you would expect to see more of the onset of El Nino conditions earlier with a stronger El Nino as well, and currently, we don't see the onset of El Nino conditions over the tropical Pacific. So it's expected to form, or that is, it's more likely that we'll have El Nino than not. However, we don't see, it is less likely that it'll be a stronger El Nino at this time from what we see.
Okay, thanks. Should I proceed with my question for Tim?
It's fine with me.
Okay. I've heard, Tim, that and hello again, by the way. I've heard that there's a problem with the sampling sites for fuel moisture in the sense that there are a lot of gaps, particularly in the North Bay, where those fires occurred last year and where many are occurring now, that there is a kind of a shortage of sampling sites. It doesn't give a very good picture of what the fuel moisture conditions really are. Do you agree that that's an issue, and what would it take to fill in those gaps?
Yeah, so I do agree that they should be filled in. The network itself is sparse, and so that would be one of my recommendations is to increase that network and make sure that it is done on a regular basis, and then further to look at supplementing that with like satellite remote sensing, vegetation greenness, for example. But that would be an area of research and looking forward. Having said their sparseness, though these are pretty big areas of, you know, these fuel types, chemise or manzanita or, you know, oak, whatever they are. And so the fuel moistures that we do have probably are mostly representative for a lot of the spaces in between. But a good analogy of this is, you know, say temperature or even precipitation might be just as good as well, that you have these stations, you know, around a region. And so it is the question, are you effectively representing, you know, temperature, precipitation for a place that has no measurement by those surrounding stations that do?
All right. Okay. I can give you a call later. We can talk more about it.
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay.
And at this time, we have no further questions queued up.
All right. Thank you, operator. If there are no further questions, I think at this time we'll go ahead and wrap up the call. Thanks once again to all of our speakers and to everyone else for participating today. I will end by reminding you to please mark your calendar for some upcoming releases from NOAA. The August 20th, which is Monday, we will put out the August Global Climate Highlights. And then the next monthly climate call is going to be held Thursday, September 20th. And finally, an audio file of this call will be posted on the NOAA.gov Media Advisory site within 90 minutes. And if you have any other informational needs, don't hesitate to email me at john.leslie@noaa.gov. My contact information is also available at the top of the media advisory. So with that, I think we'll conclude today's call. And again, thank you all for dialing in. Have a good day.
This does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation. Parties may disconnect their lines at this time.